Good morning. Welcome back to hour number two of Focus 580. It's our morning talk program. My name's David Inge. Glad to have you with us. We're also pleased here to welcome back to the program Dr. Suzanne Troopen. She is an obstetrician and a gynecologist. She also teaches at the med school here in Urbana-Champaign. And every other month on a Monday, she is here and we talk about women's health. Now, this is usually, in case you're keeping score at home, yes, she's usually here on the fourth Monday. And so she's here a week early because we're taking Memorial Day off, but we're pleased to have her here nonetheless. Now, she usually comes prepared to talk about a few things that are new, and we can do that. But more important, it's an opportunity for people who are listening to ask questions. If you have specific questions about your health, certainly you are welcome to call. I do just want to say, as I try to do when we have physicians here on the program, is that obviously they cannot do diagnosis over the telephone. There's a limit to what she can do. I don't want to discourage people from calling, but I want to make sure people understand that they may need to pursue their questions with a physician that can see them and can examine them. But this is a good place to start. We do these programs to try to add to your health knowledge, give you a chance to ask basic questions. So do call if you would like to talk with Suzanne. 333-9455 is the Champaign-Urbana number. Also, we have a toll-free line that's good anywhere that you can hear us, and that's 800-222-9455. Welcome back.
Thank you. Good morning.
There's a couple of things I know that you said you might like to talk a little bit about. All of them having to do with the human papilloma virus.
Yes.
Which has certainly been, people are now hearing more and more about it because of the HPV vaccine and because I think we know pretty well that some of these viruses, maybe we're not sure which, but some of these viruses are implicated in cervical cancer. So that's why young women are being encouraged to have the vaccine, because we think, we get the vaccine, we prevent the infection. Hopefully, a goodly number of women are not going to get cervical cancer. But I guess there's some question about which of the HPV viruses, and there are a whole bunch of them, are really the ones that are the big problem.
Right. And a lot of these viruses are highly related to each other. So just separating out how many different types of viruses was the big medical question a number of years ago. So I would give my lectures and say, well, we've now identified 50 types of HPV. And then I upscaled it to 70. And I found an old slide lecture of mine. And we were up to 200 at one point. And now I think a lot of the lectures I say 100. And deciding whether it's really a new type of virus, it has been fascinatingly interesting. But about 100 different HPV types of viruses do exist. And if you have been following the story of HPV virus testing of the cervix, we talk about the fact that there are these low-risk viruses and high-risk viruses. And we think the low-risk type of virus causes genital warts, and we think that the high-risk types of virus causes actual cervical cancer. And it really is more than just cervical cancer. We do know that some of these high-risk types of viruses cause vaginal cancer, vulvar cancers, rectal cancers, and men do get rectal cancers and urethral cancers, and men can get anal cancers, and some oral cancers are, in fact, related to the human papillomavirus as well. And so we have realized for a long time that these are indeed very important viruses, especially worldwide, where we think that a half a million women get cervical cancer each year and 250,000 women worldwide die of cervical cancer. And we've realized that people do develop immunity when you get exposed to the human papillomavirus, but the immunity that individuals develop to these viruses isn't very strong. And it doesn't necessarily eliminate the virus in every case, so that some people do eliminate their virus when infected, but many women don't. So that about 7 or 8 out of 10 Americans that get exposed to the virus will clear their virus in about 2 years, but 3 out of 10 won't clear their virus. So we've been using that as a potential vaccination strategy. And they started studying which of the viruses were most prevalent, and they've discovered that 6 and 11 were most prevalent in warts, which are quite common, and 16 and 18 are most prevalent in cervical cancer. And using that knowledge, they combined that into the Gardasil vaccine, which has been approved. And for people naive to any of those types of viruses, using that vaccine, if you get that vaccine before ever exposed, it's practically 100% preventable of ever catching that virus, because the immunity that's developed is so, so strong, mm-hmm. much better than if you ever were exposed and developed immunity and tried to clear the virus. And that's going to be a very interesting story as we watch that going forward. So that one question is if you were newly exposed and got the vaccine, is it possible that you would be more likely to clear because you could develop better immunity at the same time? We don't really know. At the same time, one of the exciting things that has sort of happened is we've been able to actually test patients to see if, in fact, they are carriers of these HPV virus strains. And that's become important because even though in the United States, women who get pap smears are very likely to get picked up prior to developing cancer, and we pick them up at the precancerous stage. We find out that they have this precancer. We can make this diagnosis. We can treat this precancer and help prevent it from ever going on to become invasive cancer. And therefore, our rate of death of cervical cancer is quite low, about 3,000 women in the United States each year. Not, you know, for those 3,000 women, still very something significant that we want to prevent, can prevent, we think, with this vaccination, but still something quite remarkable given what it used to be. But we can therefore test with this, and it's actually a more accurate test than even the pap smear. So we have been testing for the past few years with a single test that's been on the market, the Digene Hybrid Capture Test that I've talked about before, that tested for 13 different types of high-risk virus, and I don't have to number them all. But actually, a couple of years ago, a group of scientists got together, and they started talking about one of the HPV types, HPV 66, that is not in this testing group that maybe should be, that is a very significant HPV virus. So here's a problem that's kind of been looming out there. So different groups have started coming up with their own chemical tests to also test for HPV virus. And Roche Diagnostics just got FDA approved. It was just announced, just in the past few days, that the FDA approved two different HPV tests. One is a general test for 13 different types of the high-risk virus. A second test will actually be able to tell you which viruses you were exposed to. Two different companies are working on similar tests. One is with third wave technology. Also, I think some of these newer tests are going to tell you you're going to be able to tell you how accurate the test was. There's some question whether some people maybe who were told that they were positive, how accurate was that test? Was it on a really good sample or not? So these are questions that maybe some of the newer technologies are going to help us answer. Also, that will help us triage patients better. Maybe some patients need to be watched more carefully. Maybe some patients can have less frequent pap smears. It will help us understand the biology of the disease a little bit better. Maybe will help us develop the vaccines better, and maybe help us understand who is progressing more quickly to the advanced diseases. So we're very excited about some of these tests. Mm.
So just let me ask you real quick, and we have a caller we'll get to. Is there some kind of recommendation about who should be tested? Is it recommended that all women be tested for HPV exposure?
Well, it's definitely not recommended yet that all women be tested. Mm-hmm. FDA has approved that all women over the age of 30 be tested for HPV as a primary screen for cervical cancer. But women under the age of 30, we really do not want them screened primarily for HPV because it's going to be so likely to be positive. Now, if someone comes up with a slightly abnormal pap, this atypical squamous cells of undetermined significance, then it's very important to get them screened for further triage purposes.
Okay, so you come up with somebody who does test positive for these particular strange HPV, then you're going to be thinking, well, now her risk of cervical or some other cancers is going to be increased.
Right.
All right. We have a caller here on our toll-free line. Let's talk with them. Line number 4.
Yes, hello. Thank you for taking my call. It's a great program, and I'm interested in, and I'm happy that you're doing all the scientific work that you're doing. My question is on the vaccine. Why do you only vaccine women? Why wouldn't you or young girls? Why wouldn't you vaccinate and look as a carrier or a transmitter to men or young boys?
Well, they're going to have to look at men and young boys. And in Australia, they already are vaccinating men. Right. In part, well, I, in case you haven't listened to the show before, I am an OBGYN. And so the most of the research that I do is actually in women and females, although I am doing some general health research, and I do work with some sub-investigators and on some clinical trials that are involving men in certain clinical entities that both men and women get. And Merck Research and Gardasil is enrolling some trials with men and boys. The way our FDA works and the way they do approvals, they will not approve indications for products where the company has not yet submitted information that allow them to make an approval. In actuality, in my office, patients have come in and discussed the indication, and some young men have come in and paid for the vaccine, and I have vaccinated some men, and I think it's a good idea. And I think in terms of getting this entity under control, I think we are going to have to vaccinate both the vector and, the vectors both ways, so to speak, in all ways, so to speak.
Would seem like absolute, they didn't take logic when they went to...
Well, it's the way our medical system works and our approval process works. And it's the way our country works. And in order for a company to market and sell, they're going to have a reason for a young boy to take a vaccination or for a mom to have her young male vaccinated. What is going to be the emphasis for this? So, in fact, if you think about this disease, one of the reasons why they piggybacked 6 and 11, which are warts, which are definitely uncomfortable and not a fun disease to have, but certainly not the clinically significant entity cervical cancer is, one of the reasons they put the 6 and 11 in there was so that boys and young men could eventually have some potential clinical benefit of their own from getting this vaccine, other than, hey, someday you might prevent some older woman from getting cervical cancer. That's just a different way of approaching the way any other vaccination has ever been given. So that's one thing. Actually, in the news media, it's been very interesting because some throat cancers have actually now been linked to HPV disease as well. And some people think that there might possibly be a side benefit of the vaccination to decreasing oral cancers in men. So that'll be something interesting and potentially something that the public would be able to be a reason why they would want to vaccinate their boys. And I think some moms, when I talk to them, they understand the big picture. They want to see boys as well as girls vaccinated, and cost being a very expensive vaccination, 3 vaccine series. I charge $550 for the three vaccine series if you were paying cash. So cost is definitely an issue.
Cost related to death is more significant.
Oh, I know. But, I mean, still, if I'm just saying doctor to patient, that seems to be a barrier in my office. When I talk to patients, if there was zero cost to it, I think that there would already be more young men getting the vaccine. But in Australia, their laws are different. They cannot give something only to one sex just because of the way their laws are. So that is why they were not able to just approve something for one sex and not the other. So boom. They got it done.
Maybe we'll get some good Australian in the legislature next time.
Yeah.
All right. Thank you very much.
Thanks for the call. Other questions are welcome. 333-9455 and toll free 800-222-9455. Our guest is Dr. Suzanne Truppen. She is an obstetrician and a gynecologist. She also teaches at the U of I College of Medicine here in Urbana-Champaign. She has a practice here in our area, and every other month she's here, we talk about women's health. 333-9455, toll free 800-222-9455. So at this point, as far as the vaccine for the HPV is concerned, the strategy is we're vaccinating women, girls, and the idea is that because it's sexually transmitted, if you want to get the best result, you would like to vaccinate a girl before she's ever going to be sexually active.
Correct.
So having said that, though, then now the question is, okay, so you got a woman who's 25 or 30 or 40. What's the recommendation about women who already are sexually active and have had at least one sexual partner and might have more?
Well,
what's the recommendation?
The vaccine is approved, and Gardasil.com and Merck.com have phenomenal, and the CDC.com, or I guess it's CDC.gov, they all have phenomenal information on their site and every question you can think of, and we surely won't be able to answer it all. Mm-hmm. But it absolutely is approved for ages 9 to 26, and anyone, regardless of their pap smear history, who is in that age group, female, is eligible for that vaccine. And it's a three-shot series, and you want to get that shot series in under a year. It's one shot, month later, next shot, 6 months later, the second shot. And instead of getting them closer, getting them farther spaced out is better. And even if you've tested positive, it's very unlikely that you carry all four viruses. And we do undergoing testing in the older age group of females, and my office is one of the testing sites. And that data, we are madly trying to finish the early phase looking at that data to see what the immunity will be. One of the reasons we vaccinate so many vaccines in young people is our immune system is so good when we're young and not as good as we get older. So we want to know, you know, how good is the immunity going to be? How good is then the vaccination going to be at preventing dysplasia? One of the reasons that this vaccine was so exciting is because not only could we show that immunity was established so fast, but we could show so quickly that we prevented dysplasia, and preventing the precancerous change of the cervix was what prevented young women from having the surgeries of their cervix that then led to complications of pregnancy and preterm labor. And so there's so many benefits to this vaccine. So we will, I think, have answers to this older age group quickly. I think that my personal feeling is that it will benefit the older age group females for lots of different reasons. And many physicians across the country are vaccinating older women. Actually, this month's Vogue had some very interesting statements by Dr. Diane Harper. She gets into the issue of vaccinating men, too. She was one of the investigators on some of these trials. I have met her. And she's taking time off of her practice to literally travel around the country and even the world and preach about vaccination, because there are so many issues about it. And actually taking some of her own money and time and energy, just she's so interested in this subject. Mm-hmm. And so it's an interesting article. And Yet there's a lot of work to be done because there's still so much discussion about the other questions. What about these other HPV types? What other vaccines in development? We know that by combining the vaccine with the right kinds of what they call the adjuvant, the stuff the vaccine is made of, can enhance the immunity. So are there better vaccines out there? What about cofactors? We know smokers do more poorly, pick up more dysplasia, have it advance more quickly. So what other things to enhance our immune system can we do to prevent cervical disease and other kinds of cancers? So there's still a lot of questions to be answered.
Okay.
We have a lot of questions here.
Let me just say real quick one more. There is a potential problem here because it's expensive, and there are some people who, if they didn't have health insurance or their plan didn't cover it, the idea of spending $500, you know, maybe there's some people just couldn't do it. Do most health plans cover for
the health plans
women
have gotten on board
of
very
any age
quickly
or
no,
only for girls?
Health plans that have gotten on board usually pay for the indicated age groups, of course. But I've been surprised how quickly the health plans have gotten on board, particularly the ones in our area. And I know, for instance, Health Alliance has vaccinated large numbers of patients very quickly. They've done a phenomenal job with that. And so that's been very good. I know that the state has made vaccination available very quickly. So that has been excellent. And, you know, I know that $500 sounds very expensive, but, you know, you start looking at what you pay for a tank of gas. And I pay more than $50 for a tank of gas, 10 tanks of gas. You know, you start weighing these kinds of things. And, you know, I know that the university, for instance, makes it available at cost. So it's $120 absolute cost. Mm-hmm. So I know that they are making it available at cost. So I know that university age patients in our area can get it for less. So the cost is definitely an issue, but I think that people are getting vaccinated. So that's been good. And I know that worldwide, Merck is working very, very hard to provide these vaccines worldwide.
Well, we're at our midpoint here. Dr. Suzanne Troopin with us. Questions about women's health are welcome. 333-9455, toll free, 800-222-9455. We have a number of callers. We'll start in with line one right here. Hello.
Good morning.
Mm-hmm.
If one were to have a positive HPV test, does that mean you have it, or does your body ever grow immune to those viruses?
You develop immunity. You don't always develop what's called neutralizing immunity, immunity that will clear the virus. But you can be retested to see if you clear the virus. And I usually recommend to my patients that the fastest that we retest to see if you clear is usually about a year, because about the quickest most people clear their virus is about 9 months. So 9 months, you know, awkward timing. So I usually, if you are positive, depending on what the positivity is, I usually recommend colposcopy to evaluate the cervix, and then retesting, depending on what the colposcopy shows, then retesting for clearing the virus down the line. Actually, if something is done to the cervix, if the colposcopy shows dysplasia to the extent that something needs to be done, a leap or something like that to the cervix, actually those procedures can help clear the virus. I'm also involved in some research using some new therapeutic modalities that are that we're hoping will help clear the virus. Actual medical treatments, not surgical, that will help clear the virus. We have none of those treatments available right now.
But if you have a positive to one of them, does it mean that even if you clear that one, you could still be carrying some of the others? Is that correct?
Right. And that is a concern because of the tests that we've used. HPV 66 has not been in the tests that people have gotten in the past. And so, and many tests have not included the low-risk viruses, so this gets into a very detailed discussion. So in the future, there may be other HPVs that you've not even been tested for, that you may be tested for, but absolutely, there's not big crossover immunity. There's going to be some question. The new vaccine by GlaxoSmithKline is going to claim that even though their vaccine is 16-18 only, they think they're going to have some crossover immunity with 31-45 is, I think, what I've read off the top of my head. I'm not as familiar with their vaccine. I was a participant in some of the very, very early trials of that vaccine. But since it's not been on the market yet, I haven't familiarized myself as much with it.
What are the dangerous numbers of the HPV virus?
Well, 16 and 18 are the biggest ones. We think that 16 and 18 are responsible together for somewhere between 70% and 80% of all cervical cancers worldwide.
And so the other numbers?
Well, 16, 18, 31, 33, 35, 39, 45, 51, 52, 56, 58, 59, and 68 are the ones, the top 13. But at any rate, 16 and 18 are what we think in the United States. Now, when I participated in the Worldwide Investigator meeting, we split up into continents. And on different continents, there's a slightly different variation in what we see. So depending on your heritage and what continent literally you had sex on, it's a little bit different.
Thank you.
All right. Thank you. To line number two, the next caller. Hello.
Hi. Mm-hmm. Dr. Trupin, thank you for being on. I always enjoy the answers you give to some really difficult and complex questions. I was watching one of the early shows this morning. It was either Good Morning America or The Early Show. And they had a thing on about the fact that one out of three women at some time in their lives have bladder leakage problems, and even as early as 30 or 35. And they talked about lots of different products and exercises, and they talked about the sling. And the physician that was on said that it was a simple procedure and could be done vaginally rather than surgically. And I wondered, what do you know about that? And I'd like some information so I can just listen to your answer, and I'll hang up and listen. Thank you.
Okay. Thanks for the call.
It's a big problem, and it's not just vaginal leakage. What most people don't talk about is that many women also have fecal leakage at the same time, and they just don't even like to even mention it, not even to their own doctors. And people, it's a huge problem. The pelvic floor is basically a gigantic series. It's a big hammock, and it's actually a series of hammocks that intertwine. And the urethra and the vagina and the rectum all punctuate this big hammock. And basically what happens over time is that the layers rupture. And in the older surgeries, what we used to do is just sort of bring them back together. And it was sort of like repairing a stretched out rubber band. And it would work, but it never worked quite the same. And there's been a revolution in technology over about the past 7 years. And what they've discovered is by using meshes, and we've used these various meshes in other areas of surgery to repair hernias for more years than that. So these technologies are new, but they've evolved for a number of years. And so we use these meshes, and they essentially look like a micro version of a chain link fence. And what happens is that your own tissue grows in to repair what's become ruptured. And there are three types of meshes. And one is purely a biologic mesh, and it could be anything. It could be a piece of your own tissue, like a part of your leg fascia or something, or it could be a porcine skin, pig skin or something. So it could be a biologic entity or a grown something, or it could be a completely synthetic thing, or it could be an intermediary thing that they've sort of partially engineered a biologic with a structural. And there's a number of companies that have their own meshes, and some have bigger pores and some have smaller pores, and some are thicker and some are thinner and some are colored and some are not. And they all have their own little devices that they place the mesh with. And basically, this technology has completely revolutionized these repair operations. So we used to go in and we used to do these operations and we'd tell people, well, it'll probably work, meaning, my operation success rate's between about 60 and, well, we try to pretend like some of us got about 90% success rate, and we'll probably get you about 10 or maybe 20 years if you're lucky of success. But in truth, it was really rare for anybody to get more than 2 to 5 years of success, and already operations were breaking down. And many women would just not have very good results, and it would be better, but not great. So people would put off their operations for years because, you know, they were only going to get 10 years. They'd rather get the years from maybe 60 to 70. So women in their 30s and their 40s would never have operations to fix these things. And essentially what they've done with these slings is you go in vaginally. All these operations are operations, so none of them are non-surgical per se. You can inject some collagen or this or that. I'm not sure because I didn't see the program. But essentially, for fixing pure stress incontinence where you sneeze and it leaks all over, they go in, they open up the bladder neck somehow, meaning that the lining between where the urethra is and the bladder is opened up. And then somehow you hang with one of these devices, and either hang it or you place it, one of these meshes, and then you sew the vaginal mucosa shut. And then the mesh really almost immediately, some of my patients tell me that within 7 to 10 days, they're already noticing a lot of improvement on their leakage. But really over the next 3 to 6 months, the tissue is sort of growing through these pores and recreating the angle that has been lost, and the success rate is just great. Now, what's the downside? The downside is the long-term success rate of these operations has not been reported. Many of the studies only have 1 year data. Very few even have been reported 2 years data. Most of the operation reports are world experts. So those of us out in the real world don't do as many operations as the world experts. Some people sort of reject some of the mesh, so you have to go in and get some of that mesh trimmed out now and then. But mesh erosions and mesh removal operations are unfortunately more common than they lead you to believe. Not so impossible to do or so hard, but does have to be done. But absolutely, these operations have revolutionized this area of medicine, and it can be done as an outpatient. Some of the quicker ones supposedly can be done under local anesthesia. I've not seen any done under local, and they're quick. A skilled operator can do the procedure in 15 to 20 minutes. But still going to sleep is still a better way to be done. But outpatient, I don't send my patients home with Foley catheters in most cases. And patients go back to work in a couple of days. So that's probably what they were talking about. And they are great operations.
Okay. It's how common a problem is stress incontinence in younger women?
Well, it's very common right immediately after birth, but it improves. And if you use your Kegel exercises, it will improve. And even though it's relatively common in younger women, we don't like to fix things until people are done having kids, because it's just going to potentially ruin that operation, or they're going to have a cesarean birth. Not that isn't, pretty common you know, that's another discussion, but really it has not been approved for patients planning more deliveries. So we don't recommend people have any sort of operation for that till after they're done having kids.
I think for women and for men, both, more minor incontinence problems. So one of the first things I imagine that gets suggested is that people do the Kegels exercise. Can that really help?
Oh, yeah. Definitely. But really, it's a ruptured ligament that is the real problem. And the exercise strengthens muscles that are around the area of the ligament. So so no matter how much you work the muscles, it's never going to repair the ligament.
Uh-huh. Other questions? So next is line one right here. Hello. Caller there, line one.
Yes, hello.
Yes.
I have a question. I have a hernia and the doctor said, don't worry about it unless it hurts. And it doesn't hurt, but it's if I cough or sneeze, it's like right above my belly button. And if I cough or sneeze or press down or if I have a hard bowel movement, it gives me trouble. Is that right to just ignore it? He said all women that have had children usually have a hernia.
Well, that sounds like an umbilical hernia, and small umbilical hernias are very unlikely to get trapped and cause significant medical problems. So it is true that small umbilical hernias not causing active medical problems aren't usually surgically repaired. But like with any other medical entity, a second opinion's always welcome if you're not sure you're getting the right answer.
All right. Thank you.
All right. Let's go to line number two and have another caller here. Hello. So there's someone there. Line two.
Yes. Good morning.
Yeah. Hi.
I just had a question about the incontinence problem. Is that something that's more common with women who've had a physically traumatic birth, or is that common even in normal birth situations?
Well, carrying a pregnancy seems to be the most common factor. Although some families with certain genetic predispositions seems to be the factor, because certain types of collagen, there are a number of different types of collagen, and so certain genetic backgrounds with certain weaker types of collagen are more predisposed. So just being pregnant is the first factor. So there's big arguments. Experts disagree as to whether or not just having a cesarean birth would protect your pelvis against this or not. Some people say yes, and some people say no. So the first answer is whether or not just having a C-section versus vaginal delivery helps to protect the pelvic floor. Some experts will say yes to this. Okay, then the next question is if you're going to have a vaginal delivery, is a traumatic vaginal delivery a problem or not? Definitely a traumatic vaginal delivery that leads to lacerations of the entire rectum will affect the fecal incontinence problem. Now, whether or not it's going to also affect stress incontinence, definitely in the short run it does. But if you look out 2, 3, 4 years down the line with proper Kegel exercises, control for weight gain, control for some of the other issues, becomes less clear. And in certain studies, it's a factor. In certain studies, what we call the p-value, the significance is, it's just such a weak fact that there's a trend, but the p-value not significant enough for us to feel like that's that important. Certainly not a p-value significant enough to advocate one direction or another. So maybe not a reason not to use forceps. Maybe not a reason not to have a vacuum. Maybe not a reason to have a C-section. Those sorts of decisions probably aren't strong enough yet to weigh into any real obstetrical planning.
Okay, I hope that gets to the question of the call. Let's go again to another caller. This is line three.
Yes. Will this sling help rectal incontinence?
The sling operation I was talking about, really I was just talking about the stress incontinence. Now there are, yes, an entire set of mesh operations that have to do with the rectocele and rectal incontinence. But some of the sling operations that have been designed, they're not truly slings. They're pelvic floor meshes, and they're three out there. The placement, understanding the anatomy and the placement of these operations, a little bit complex, and not very many surgeons have been trained to do them, and complication rate, a little bit high if you haven't been trained to do them. But we think that the success rate's going to be much, much better. A lot depends on what is the cause of the problem. But yes, for some patients, it will help that problem.
Now, is this a procedure that you do?
Well, I have been trained in that, and it is something that I do, depending on what the situation is. And but yes, it's something that I have been training to do. Yes.
Thank you.
All right. Other questions are welcome. Our guest is Dr. Suzanne Troopin. She's an obstetrician and a gynecologist. She has a practice in our area. She teaches at the U of I Med School. Every other month on a Monday, she's here. We talk about women's health. And we have about 10 minutes left on the program. Questions are welcome. 333-9455. Toll free, 800-222-9455. I want to ask you about something else that you mentioned just before we got going. Some people perhaps will recall back in the day when we were really enthusiastic about hormonal replacement therapy, and there seemed to be a long list of potential benefits. One of them that was suggested was that it seemed like maybe hormone replacement therapy would be good to prevent or lessen the risk of dementia. So we would talk about that for a while. And then we came along and said, well, actually, no, we really don't think that that is. Well, now we've got a study that's just come out that again says, well, maybe it is.
It's been so frustrating because the information has gone back and forth in trying to merge the scientific information with the clinical information. It's just gone round and round and round. And part of it has been mixing apples with oranges, and part of it has been mixing information with women who were younger just getting on hormone therapy versus the women that were much older. And the newest information is, again, women who got on hormone therapy as they were getting into menopause. And these younger women, they're saying that, in fact, yes, estrogen therapy might be protective against dementia. Not that it caused dementia, as the Women's Health Initiative seemed to say, remembering that the Women's Health Initiative data was in women average age was age 63 when they got on the study. So this Women's Health Initiative study really was confounding for us.
But so it seems that, as you say, that the particularly here the issue is, what? How old was the woman when she started? And you can't start when you're 70,
right,
and have some effect. You really have to start,
right,
when you're younger.
Right. But at the same time, there was a new fascinating study that said, hey, there may be a group of patients that's older that could benefit from starting hormone therapy. It was the first thing that I had read like this, and I kind of caused me to prick up my ears. They were studying a group of hepatitis C patients, and these were patients that had very advanced liver disease. And actually, I was shooting off a letter to, I ran into this friend of mine who is a gastroenterologist this morning, but I was running. I didn't have time to stop him and ask him about this article that was in Gut, one of the journals I don't read. But I only saw a summary, but talked about women who had advanced hepatitis C and advanced fibrosis, and actually they did better if they were on hormone therapy. These women were over the age of 60, and they did better with their liver disease if they were on hormone therapy than if they didn't. It was a very odd, isolated report. So, you know, just when you think that you've got everybody pigeonholed, well, you can't quite pigeonhole everyone.
All right, let's talk with someone else. Line one. Hello.
Hello.
Yes.
I'd like to know from Dr. Troopin, the vaginal cavity has fallen and it's impacting the rectum and the bladder, how serious an operation is that to repair?
Well, that's an excellent question. And are we talking about somebody that still has her uterus or somebody that doesn't have her uterus?
Does not have her uterus.
Well, traditionally, if someone had had a uterus, we always repaired this with a hysterectomy. But with these new meshes, these are repairs that can now be done, keeping the uterus in place, which is kind of interesting and a whole separate story. But traditionally, if you have a cystocele or a rectocele or a vaginal vault prolapse where the vault is sticking outside of the introitus, the opening of the vagina, when you're just at rest sitting, that is pretty much the indication for needing something done. And the question is, what can actually be done? Well, the only alternative that we have are pessaries, and there are a number of companies that make pessaries now. They used to only be made out of latex, but there are great ones now being made out of silicone that are pretty soft and pretty comfortable, lots easier to insert. They come in literally dozens of configurations now, and it takes a little trial and error, and they're a little fussy to use, but you can use these devices to hold everything up in place so that you don't have to have surgery. So that's an option for much older women. We can't always tell how old people are on the phone here, but for much older women who are definitely not going to be sexually active, there are operations that literally can shut down the vagina that are fairly quick, and they're extremely effective. Literally, they cannot fail. I guess anybody who says that, it's possible to fail, I suppose. But they really are very effective, and especially for individuals who aren't very good surgical candidates, they're fairly quick operations, so they can be done very effectively. And yet for younger people or slightly older women with medical problems, some of these operations can be fairly extensive. So one of the problems was trying to figure out, are you bad enough to need surgery? The surgery is fairly extensive. You need to be not doing heavy lifting, so forth, for 6 to 8 weeks. So when do you operate? Well, with these meshes, the operative time is so reduced, the success rate is so much better that I think more and more patients are going to be able to be successfully treated with more moderate degrees of prolapse. But still, it's an individual decision. The other thing is we used to always do a whole operation no matter what was wrong. And we've really come away from that. So now we try to make a diagnosis. So if we have lateral defects, we correct lateral defects. If we have anterior defects, we correct anterior defects. If we have posterior defects, we correct that. If we have entrocele where small bowel's coming down from the top, we correct that. So the first thing is to get an accurate diagnosis if possible. Sometimes that's not completely possible till somebody gets you under anesthesia and kind of starts to dissect and figure out what's wrong. But you get an accurate diagnosis and fix what's wrong. And by doing that and doing a very specifically tailored operation, people are getting the best success rates.
Okay. Well, thank you.
All right. Thanks for the call. We are coming down to, we have maybe about a minute or so. Is there any last hair item you'd like to mention?
I figured for sure somebody would call me about mammographies and the new MRIs and all the new recommendations, because all of that, there's been quite a bit of that in the media. And there was quite a bit talking about how people with strong genetic risk maybe would be better off having MRIs rather than mammograms, because using mammography in patients with very strong family histories of breast cancer possibly could have an increased risk of breast cancer from having too many mammograms, where getting exposed to radiation could increase the risk, and maybe this group of patients should have MRIs. Problem is, access to MRIs, affording the MRIs, getting insurance to cover MRIs. So this has been a big problem. Also deciding who has this risk. They talk about patients that maybe have a lifetime risk of 25%. Well, this is based on some of these scales where we calculate what their risk is, but some of these scales don't take into consideration mixed race heritage, lots of other things. They, for instance, take into consideration exactly when your first period was. Well, what if you don't know exactly and so forth? So there's been just a lot of discussion about this. I think that it's probably too soon for patients to really be changing what they're doing. But I do think that we are going to hear a lot more about it and that some people are going to probably shy away from mammograms and try to get their MRIs if they can in the future.
Yeah. And we've also talked about the fact that there are, for some women, an MRI actually might give you better information than the conventional mammogram.
It might give you better information, but it might give you too much information. They've done some studies where they've estimated that it might increase your biopsy rate by about 20% to find these extra cancers. So that would be unfortunate as well. But there's so many new tests. We're hoping to introduce the HALO test, and I was hoping to have more information about. That's why I wasn't really going to talk about, but we only have a couple of seconds left. But it's going to actually be a pap smear test for women ages 25 to 40, where mammograms are so inaccurate, to be a screening tool for breast cancers. And it's going to be kind of interesting, but I'm hoping that we'll have it within about the next month. So in my next radio show, hopefully I'll be talking about it for sure.
Okay. Dr. Suzanne Truppin, she's an obstetrician and gynecologist with a practice in our area. She also teaches at the U of I College of Medicine here in Urbana-Champaign. Every other month she is here on the fourth Monday, generally, to talk about women's health. So we will see you again in July, right?
July.
All right. Very good. Thank you.